Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, everyone.
So imagine for a second that you're going to the doctor because you've been dealing with like a truly baffling combination of symptoms.
Right, the kind that just don't seem to fit together at all.
Exactly. You've got chronic gastrointestinal issues, your joints are, you know, unusually flexible, maybe prone to pain.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, your heart just suddenly starts racing the second you stand up from a chair.
It's a lot to deal with.
It really is. And in the current medical system, you might get sent to three completely different specialists, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you might walk away with three separate, seemingly unrelated diagnoses.
Right. Like a gastroenterologist tells you it's IBS, a rheumatologist says maybe Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
And the cardiologist diagnoses POTS, or postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
Exactly. So you're handed three different treatment plans for what look like three distinct problems.
But what if they aren't actually different problems?
Right. What if a single hidden genetic quirk was actually connecting them all?
That is the million-dollar question.
Because today we are doing a deep dive into this like invisible genetic modifier that actually affects roughly 1 in 20 people.
Yeah, that's 4-6% of the general population.
Which is huge, but it routinely goes completely undiagnosed.
Today we celebrate the work of the research team at the University Medical Center Groningen and the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, who have advanced our understanding of hereditary alpha-tryptosemia diagnostics.
Yeah, it's really incredible work. But so right out of the gate, I mean, how does a genetic condition that affects up to 6% of the population remain so hidden from routine clinical diagnostics?
Well, to understand that blind spot, we really have to look at the underlying biology.
Okay.
Specifically, we need to talk about mast cells. They are essentially the immune system's first responders, you know.
Right, so they're like out on patrol.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They hang out in tissues that interface with the outside world.
Yeah.
So your skin, your respiratory tract, your gut.
Makes sense.
And they're packed with these little granules full of potent chemicals, just ready to be released during an allergic reaction or an inflammatory response.
Gotcha. And one of the main chemicals in those granules is this enzyme called tryptase, right?
Spot on. It's a primary enzyme stored right there in the mast cells.
Okay, so let's focus on that enzyme for a second, because I want to bridge the gap between immune cells and those mechanical issues we mentioned, like flexible joints or a racing heart.
Right, the clinical symptoms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does an immune enzyme lead to all of that?
Well, it comes down to what tryptase actually does when it's released into the tissues.
Okay, what does it do?
It's a protease. So its job is to break down proteins. And it's really heavily involved in homeostatic processes.
Meaning, like, keeping things balanced.
Yeah, keeping your airway, your blood vessels, and your gastrointestinal smooth muscles functioning normally.
Right.
But when there's chronically too much tryptase just sort of seeping into the surrounding tissues, it starts to subtly alter the extracellular matrix.
Which is like the structural scaffolding of the body.
Exactly. And it can also affect vascular smooth muscle tone.
Oh, I see. Okay, let's unpack this. Because if your vascular tone is altered and your blood vessels are like overly relaxed, then gravity is going to pull your blood downward when you stand.
Which is exactly what happens.
And then your heart has to rapidly accelerate to pump that blood back up to your brain.
Yes, and that rapid acceleration is what manifests clinically as POTS.
Wow. And I'm guessing those subtle changes to the connective tissue matrix lead to the joint hypermobility and pain we associate with Ehlers-Danlos.
Exactly right. The overproduction of tryptase alters the baseline functioning of these systems.
That is wild.
It is. And that brings us to the focus of this research, which is a condition called hereditary alpha-tryptosemia, or HALT.
I think it's alpha-T, okay.
Yeah. It's an autosomal dominant genetic condition caused by simply having extra copies of the alpha-tryptase gene.
Right, an autosomal dominant, meaning you only need to inherit the extra copy from one parent to express the trait.
Exactly.
But having extra copies of a gene doesn't always result in, you know, an actual pathology. So what is the actual clinical burden for someone walking around with HALT?
Well, it essentially acts as a massive clinical amplifier. It's a hidden modifier of other diseases.
Modifier, okay.
Right, so like we discussed, it can mimic IBS, or POTS. But the true danger really emerges when H-alpha T intersects with other primary mast cell disorders.
Like what?
Well, consider a patient with a rare condition called systemic mastocytosis, or SM.
Okay.
In SM, the body just naturally produces an abnormally high number of mast cells.
Oh, so they already have too many of those first responder cells.
Right. Now factor in an environmental trigger, like an allergy to wasp stings.
Okay, so you have way too many mast cells, and then you encounter a severe allergen.
Exactly. And if that patient also happens to have H-alpha T, their risk of experiencing fatal anaphylaxis from that wasp sting drastically increases.
Wait, really? Just because of the extra gene copies?
Yes, the extra copies of the alpha tryptase gene modify and amplify the severity of the reaction. The baseline genetic code is acting like a multiplier.
Wow, that changes the whole paradigm. I mean, it means the wasp sting isn't the primary danger, it's just the trigger. The patient's baseline genetic code is acting like a loaded gun.
That's a great way to put it.
So if it's this critical, I mean, if it's amplifying severe reactions, why is it such a nightmare to actually diagnose?
Yeah, that's the real problem.
Like if I go to my doctor and ask for a genetic test, why can't they just, you know, run my DNA and count the genes?
Well, the difficulty lies entirely in the architecture of the genetic neighborhood where this gene lives.
The neighborhood.
Yeah. The human tryptase locus is located on chromosome 16.
Okay.
And the relevant genes here are TPSAB1, which encodes either alpha or beta tryptase.
Right.
And TPSB2, which only encodes beta tryptase.
Got it. So TPSAB1 is alpha or beta, and TPSB2 is just beta.
Exactly. But the problem for geneticists is that this entire region of the genome is highly repetitive.
How repetitive are we talking?
Extremely. The beta tryptase sequences are 98 to 99% identical to each other.
Wow.
And the alpha sequences are about 93% identical to the beta sequences.
Oh man, okay, let's unpack this. Doing standard, like short read genetic sequencing on this region has to be essentially like trying to read a massive book where consecutive pages are 98% identical.
That's exactly what it's like.
You're gonna constantly lose your place.
The sequencing machines certainly do. I mean, a standard machine reads short fragments of DNA and tries to stitch them together based on overlapping patterns.
Right.
But when the sequences are nearly identical repeats, the machine just gets confused. It can't determine if it's reading a new copy of the gene or if it's just rereading the exact same copy it just looked at.
So the whole linear sequence just collapses into an ambiguous blur.
Precisely.
Okay, so if standard genomic sequencing gets lost in the repetitive pages, how can doctors actually measure this to help you? I mean, we have millions of patients looking for answers, and our primary genetic reading tools are basically useless here.
Right. Well, the conceptual breakthrough is that you have to stop trying to, you know, read the genetic sequence linearly.
Yeah.
Instead, you have to start physically counting the individual pieces.
Oh, counting.
Yeah. And that shift in strategy is really the core methodology of this deep dive.
So how do they count them?
Well, historically, the gold standard for diagnosing H-alpha T was this highly complex double well digital droplet PCR assay.
Double well digital droplet PCR.
It worked, but it was really cumbersome. So the research team in the Netherlands set out to streamline this by developing a highly efficient single well multiplex digital droplet PCR assay.
Single well. And we call this DDPCR for short, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, let's break down that technology for the listener, because digital droplet PCR is vastly different from the traditional PCR most people might be familiar with.
Yeah, it really is a different beast.
How does a single well multiplex DDPCR actually work in practice?
So the fundamental difference is partitioning.
Hmm.
In traditional PCR, you amplify DNA in one bulk solution, right?
Right, like one big test tube.
Yeah, and you estimate the starting amount based on how quickly the target amplifies. It's an estimation.
Okay.
But in digital droplet PCR, the process becomes absolute.
How so?
First, you extract DNA from a patient's blood or bone marrow. It has to be high quality. And it's carefully diluted to an optimal concentration of exactly 50 nanograms per milliliter.
Exactly 50. Okay.
Then the sample is forced through a microscopic fluidic channel where it intersects with an oil mixture.
Wait, oil? Why oil?
Because that partitions the sample into thousands of microscopic water and oil droplets.
Oh, wow. So you are separating the diluted DNA fragments into roughly 20,000 tiny independent compartments.
Basically 20,000 independent test tubes, yeah.
That's incredible.
And inside those droplets, the researchers place specific fluorescent probes. They use a chemical dye called HEX, which is engineered to glow only when it binds to the alpha variant.
Okay, HEX for alpha.
Right. And they use another dye called FAM, which glows only when it binds to the beta variant.
But wait, earlier you mentioned that the alpha and beta sequences are 93% identical.
Yes, they are.
If they are that similar, how does the machine tell them apart once they're in the droplets?
Well, the researchers designed the HEX and FAM probes to target the specific nucleotide differences. You know, that 7% variation that actually distinguishes alpha from beta.
Oh, clever. So the probes just ignore the identical regions and latch on to the unique identifier.
Exactly.
Okay, so if I'm picturing this, it's like we have all these different colored beads, the genes strung together on a necklace.
Okay, I like that analogy.
And the ddPCR is basically a machine that sorts those individual beads into thousands of tiny cups. Then we just shine a light on the cups and count how many glow with the HEX color for alpha and how many glow with the FAM color for beta.
That is the core mechanism, yes. But it requires a really critical preparatory step.
What's that?
Well, before partitioning the DNA into the droplets, the researchers used a specific restriction enzyme called BAMHI.
BAMHI.
Right. And they used it to literally digest or chop up the DNA into pieces.
Whoa, wait a minute. But isn't chopping up the DNA risky? How do we know we aren't destroying the very sequence we're trying to measure? I mean, taking biochemical scissors to the sample feels counterproductive.
I know it sounds that way, but what's fascinating here is that digesting the DNA actually corrects a massive potential measurement error.
Really? How?
Well, you're destroying the broader chromosomal context, sure, but you are isolating the functional units. It prevents the system from underestimating the number of alpha copies.
Why would it underestimate them?
Because in patients with hereditary alpha tryptosemia, the extra alpha tryptase copies often sit directly next to each other on the same chromosome. We call this being cis-formatted.
Oh, well, I say the physical problem. If I have a necklace where two blue beads are glued tightly together, and I toss them into a sorting cup, without cutting the string between them, they go into the exact same cup.
Exactly. And because they're in the same droplet, they would emit a single, slightly brighter fluorescent signal.
So the optical reader would look at that droplet, see the HEX dye glowing, and record it as a single positive event.
Right. It would count one alpha copy, completely missing the fact that there are actually two copies physically linked inside that droplet.
Wow, so the BAMHI restriction enzyme is the solution to that.
Yes, it acts as those microscopic scissors you mentioned. It recognizes these specific sequences flanking the genes and cuts the DNA string just outside the targets.
That is brilliant. By severing the physical connection between those tandem gene copies, BAMHI ensures that every individual copy floats freely.
Which virtually guarantees that each gene gets sorted into its own separate droplet.
Right, so it transitions this from just an estimation to absolute precise quantification. You're no longer guessing based on signal strength. You're getting an exact, discrete count of the alpha and beta genes.
Spot on.
Okay, so the methodology makes a lot of sense. Building a high-tech droplet sorter with biochemical scissors is brilliant in theory.
Yeah.
But biological samples are notoriously messy.
Oh, very messy.
So how did this new single-well assay actually perform when they moved it from theoretical validation to real patients with unexplained symptoms?
Well, the laboratory performance data was incredibly robust. They have validated the assay on a clinical cohort of 281 cases.
That's a solid number.
Yeah, and they evaluated the accuracy of determining the copy number of variants, which is obviously the ultimate goal. The overall accuracy was calculated at 0.03 plus or minus 0.27 copy numbers.
Wow.
And that's at a 99% prediction interval.
Let's translate those statistics into clinical reality. A 0.03 margin of error at a 99% prediction interval basically means the margin of error is clinically non-existent.
Exactly. It's highly, highly accurate.
So for a lab tech running this test, the machine isn't returning a report saying, this patient might have two or three copies.
Well, no, it is definitively saying this patient has exactly three copies.
The precision removes all the diagnostic muddy waters.
It really does.
Yeah.
But the research team didn't stop at merely validating the genetic counting mechanism.
Oh, what else did they do?
They needed to prove that what they were counting in the DNA actually mapped to what was happening physically in the body.
Right, connecting the genetics to the symptoms.
Yeah, so to do this, they isolated a subset of 141 highly symptomatic patients from the larger cohort.
Okay, And they had to be careful with that cohort, right? Because if you're trying to prove a direct link between a gene and a protein level, you have to remove any other biological noise that might artificially inflate those protein levels.
Oh, they were meticulous about that.
Yeah.
They completely ruled out any patients in the subset who had other known causes for elevated tryptase.
Like what?
Well, for instance, they excluded patients with end-stage renal failure. Because if your kidneys are failing, they can't clear tryptase from the blood, which leads to an artificial elevation.
Makes sense.
They also excluded primary systemic mastocytosis. They only looked at people where the elevated baseline tryptase was an unexplained mystery.
Okay, so you have this really pure cohort of symptomatic patients. You have their exact genetic droplet counts. And you draw their blood to measure the actual amount of tryptase protein floating in their system.
Right.
What did they find when they overlaid those two data sets?
They documented a stunning gene-dose relationship.
Really?
Yeah, they discovered that for every single extra alpha tryptase copy a patient inherits, their basal serum tryptase level, or BST, increases by an average of exactly 7.5 nanograms per milliliter.
Here's where it gets really interesting. In human biology, systems are almost never that clean.
No, they really are.
Biology is inherently messy. There are usually a dozen interacting variables, feedback loops, epigenetic factors altering protein expression.
Exactly.
To see a perfectly linear, predictable mathematical relationship where one extra genetic copy equals exactly 7.5 nanograms per milliliter of protein in the blood, that is rare.
It is a remarkable demonstration of direct causality in human genetics. The physical presence of the gene, directly and predictably, drives the physiological dosage of the enzyme.
So if the blood levels match the genetics so perfectly, is there a magic number in a basic blood test that tells a doctor to look for HLFT? I mean, do they even need to start with the complex droplet PCR?
That's the beauty of it. Yes, yeah. There is a magic number. Through their statistical analysis of the cohort, they established that a BST cutoff of 9.2 nanograms per milliliter is highly predictive.
9.2, okay.
Yeah. If a symptomatic patient presents with a serum tryptase level of 9.2 or higher, it predicts the presence of hereditary alpha-tryptosemia with 98.1% sensitivity.
Wow.
And 96.6% specificity.
That is massive for routine clinical practice.
It really is.
If you come in with chronic gastro issues or hypermobility, a general practitioner doesn't need to order specialized genomics immediately.
Right, they don't have to.
They can just run a standard, inexpensive blood test for basal serum tryptase. And if it comes back at 10 or 12 nanograms per milliliter, it is a giant flashing light saying, run the droplet PCR. This patient likely has a hidden genetic modifier.
Exactly. And we connect this to the bigger picture. That workflow is exactly the paradigm shift this paper represents.
It's a huge shift.
It is. This single-well multiplex ddPCR assay isn't just some interesting laboratory experiment designed for research. It is ready to be implemented right now as a state-of-the-art routine diagnostic test.
That's fantastic.
And to facilitate that global implementation, the researchers took one more crucial step. They established standardized reference controls.
Oh, right, because clinical diagnostics require consistency.
Yeah.
If a lab in Tokyo and a lab in Toronto both buy the equipment to run this droplet assay, they need a way to prove their machines are calibrated to read the droplets identically.
Exactly. So they characterize two specific immortalized cell lines to serve as global benchmarks. They use the HMC 1.2 cell line, which naturally has zero alpha tryptase copies, to act as a perfect negative control.
Smart.
And for the positive control, they utilize the Monomax 6 cell line, which is proven to carry an alpha duplication.
Oh, so any diagnostic lab can run these standardized cells alongside a human patient sample.
Right.
And if the machine reads zero alphas for the negative control and shows the duplication for the positive control, the technician knows with absolute certainty that the assay is accurately sorting and counting the genetic droplets for the patient.
It creates a universal standard for diagnostic accuracy.
So what does this all mean? We have a new, highly accurate assay. It is backed up by beautiful linear mathematics linking the genetics to the blood work. It has standardized global controls.
Yeah.
But let's get a reality check. Is this assay completely flawless, or does it have blind spots that doctors need to watch out for?
Well, it is a massive technological leap forward.
Yeah.
But, it does have specific limitations. Practically speaking, it requires a minimum input of 10 nanograms of high-quality DNA to achieve reliable droplet saturation.
So you can't run this on highly degraded samples?
No, you can't. But the more profound limitation involves structural overlap.
What do you mean?
While the assay is brilliant at counting the total number of alpha and beta copies in a sample, it cannot definitively tell you how those copies are distributed across the two chromosomes.
Wait, if it just counts the total number of glowing beads in the cups, how does it know which side of the family they came from? Let's say the final droplet count shows a patient has a total ratio of 2 beta copies and 4 alpha copies.
Right.
The machine just sees 6 total units.
And that is the structural puzzle. That 2 beta 4 alpha ratio definitively diagnoses the patient with H-alpha-T. But genetically, there are 2 distinct ways to arrive at that final count.
Okay, how so?
A patient could have a double duplication on one allele, meaning one chromosome holds 1 beta and 3 alphas, while the other chromosome is perfectly normal.
Got it.
Alternatively, a patient could have a triplication on one allele and a normal gene on the other. Both spatial arrangements yield the exact same total bead count in the droplets.
Oh, I see. But does that chromosomal distribution actually matter for treating the patient? I mean, if the total amount of tryptase in the blood is driving the symptoms, does the physical arrangement on the chromosome change the medical management?
For routine clinical care, it largely doesn't matter.
Okay, good.
The total genetic load is what drives the baseline serum tryptase, and the serum tryptase drives the severity of the symptoms. So knowing the absolute total count is sufficient for managing a patient's condition.
Right.
However, in rare ambiguous cases where knowing the exact chromosomal distribution is necessary, such as complex family planning or highly specialized genetic research, this assay hits a wall.
So what do you do then?
In those cases, parental genotyping might be required.
Ah.
Yeah. By testing the parents, you can trace exactly how the clusters of copies were inherited and solve the spatial arrangement.
That makes total sense. Okay, let's pull all of these threads together. By developing a highly precise, single-well, digital droplet PCR assay, researchers have unlocked a reliable way to diagnose hereditary alpha-tryptosemia.
They really have.
They utilized a restriction enzyme to isolate individual gene copies, allowing them to decode a highly complex, repetitive genetic region. And furthermore, they proved that this genetic quirk isn't just background noise, right? Every extra alpha-tryptase gene directly drives up serum tryptase levels by exactly 7.5 nanograms per milliliter, providing a clear biological mechanism for a host of syndromic symptoms.
What does this mean for the thousands of patients currently navigating the medical system with a patchwork of generic systemic diagnoses who might finally be one highly accurate droplet test away from a clear genetic answer?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Quiet lab heat, a tiny storm in droplets keeps time with the beat. I'm chasing a number that won't sit still in the hush of a sample. A stubborn thrill. Cut the DNA clean, let the pieces fall. Count every signal like a roll call. If the clusters don't blur, the truth comes through. One well, one red, no guesswork to do. If it's 9.2, let it ring true. A line in the blood says what genes might do. Extra alpha copies turning up the flame. Dose by dose, they call your name. If it's 9.2, we finally see what was hiding in plain biology. The sky looks clear. Symptoms and the daylight answers disappear. Now the copy numbers snap into view. Alpha and beta in a multiplex groove. And the baseline rises steady and straight like footsteps climbing toward the gate. Shadows share the same disguise. tell from noise to proof.